Geraldine Brooks is a most unusual writer, and I think one of the great ones in the world today. It turns out she's listened to some of our radio programs too, which is incredibly flattering. So let's have some fun. And there will be time for, we'll make time for questions from the audience. There is a general sort of rubric around this whole book festival in this era, where we find ourselves. It's kind of genius in ambiguity. Where the hell are we, to put it politely? But also, how did we figure it out, if we ever do? And Geraldine is a finder in all sorts of places, in history, in faraway spots in the world, a conflicted world. So I hope she's going to guide us. The book, in a certain sense, that we were assigned to talk about is The Secret Chord, about King David. Not the statue in Florence, the real guy, enormously powerful, conflicted, multifarious warrior, author of the Psalms, lover, everything. And I want to get to that. But Geraldine, I'd love to go off the high board around March, which is a novel about us, our history, Concord, Thoreau, Emerson, and the father of the girls in Little Women. So it's a compound sort of plunge into an unanswered space, an undefined space, where father of the March girls disappears to the Civil War and then comes back, changed in so many ways. What I love about it is your understanding of the whole scene, including our man, 200 years old now, Henry David Thoreau. And leap in wherever you choose, and I'll try to keep up.
Right, so I actually have my husband on the back there to blame for writing March, because we got married and almost immediately set off on a 14-year journey as foreign correspondents, living all over the world, and finally he was homesick and said, we have to spend some time back in my home place. And so we settled in a little village, really, in rural Virginia. And I knew he was kind of interested in the Civil War, but I didn't realize the extent of it. And there's this saying that the Civil War was fought in 10,000 places, and after we moved to Virginia, I realized he intended to drag me to every single one of them. And so I thought, I'm going to have to find a way to connect with this or shoot myself in the face if I have to go to another reenactment at Gettysburg on the 4th of July when it is so hot, you know. So March was the answer to that question. I was interested in the question of idealists at war, because the village that we lived in was a Quaker village. It had been settled in 1733, and of course Quakers are pacifists, but they were also ardent abolitionists, and when the Civil War broke out, some of the young men of the village decided to take up arms and were read out of their Quaker meeting as a result. So I was interested in the fate of the idealist who goes to war highly motivated for a good cause and then is forced to do deplorable things in pursuit of the cause, as young people are required to do in every war. And so I'm thinking about that, and then I realize that there's this perfect found object, this vehicle to explore this, which is the absent father in Little Women, because we're told on the first page of that wonderful novel that he's gone to minister to the Union troops because he's an abolitionist, even though he's way too old to be going off to war. And I thought, oh, that's so perfect, because she doesn't tell us anything about him. He gets sick and he recovers and he comes home, but we hear nothing about his war. And so that's the void where I could work. And so I thought, well, you know, given that Louisa May based, you know, Jo on herself, and her other sisters are the models for the Little Women, I wonder if there's any little thing in her father's biography I could use to I'm really embarrassed I didn't know who Bronson Alcott was. As one of the reviewers of the book put it more eloquently than I could, if Thoreau and Emerson are the shooting stars of American idealism, Alcott was the dark matter from which they drew their energy.
And it's interesting, Walt Whitman, who was discovered by Emerson, also went off to tend to the sick in
yes.
Civil War.
Right, yes, I pillaged his memoirs.
Good. And our own neighborhood opera composer, Matt O'Coyne, has made a huge piece, which is gathering new revivals, but began here. His opera about Walt Whitman in the hospitals. Quick parenthesis, do you want to account for your sort of British Commonwealth speech before we go any further?
British Commonwealth? I'll give you British Commonwealth. I'm an Aussie, mate.
That's enough. Okay.
And don't come the raw prawn with me.
Come back to Emerson and Thoreau and Lydia Emerson. You put flesh on those bones, on that prose, as I don't know when I've seen it. I mean, we've been through a summer of celebrating Thoreau on his 200th birthday, but you have him as this kind of hairy-handed, muscular, almost silent character who was lusting for Emerson's wife all that time. It's not exactly a brand new story, but say what you want to about these guys.
Well, you know, I mean, you can't read the bare biographies there and come to any other conclusion, I reckon. I mean, it is his falling out with Emerson happens, you know, when Emerson's been away and he and Lydian have been thrown together. And of course, you know, Emerson made it very clear to Lydian all through their marriage that she was very second fiddle to his first wife. So why wouldn't she fall for this gorgeous, dreamy guy?
With a big nose.
So what? And I mean, I think, you know, there's been so much talk about Thoreau and all these kind of, you know, brutal reassessments of him. But when you read about how he was with the kids that he was entrusted to educate, he was fantastic. I mean, he was a child psychologist of, like, a remarkable sensitivity.
Right.
And, you know, I'll always be in love with him.
Yeah, Emerson's son, Edward, I think, wrote maybe the best book on Thoreau, and they adored him.
Yeah,
forever.
And so did Louisa May.
Yeah. John Brown of Harper's Ferry makes an appearance before Harper's Ferry in your book. He makes an appearance in Concord. He speaks in the town hall, as I remember you put it.
Yeah.
And that question of violence to liberate millions of slaves is still a question. And the questions, I mean, everybody understands there's some vague parallel between the Fugitive Slave Act and now the order to arrest illegal immigrants or undocumented immigrants in this world today. It was a turning point in Thoreau's thinking. Do you want to give a little condensation of what your man March discovered about John Brown and that question, war?
You know, so the best thing about John Brown is you can't put him in a box. Everybody wants to, you know, same husband wrote a book about John Brown called Midnight Rising. And people want to demonize him or they want to lionize him, but the beauty of John Brown is he defies that. He is so complex. And Bronson Alcott saw that. So every thought that I give my fictional Mr. March is taken straight from Bronson Alcott's very conflicted account of going to hear him speak and being overwhelmed by his passion and his Old Testament moral ardor, and then being very dubious about the means. And and then, you know, Brown became much more of a hero during the time of his arrest, and Thoreau actually, you know, had to gave the moving speech about Brown on the day of the hanging, and nobody wanted him to do it.
Brown John Brown as Jesus.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and you know, and he's getting Emerson particularly didn't want him to do it, and he says, "I'm not coming to you for permission. I'm coming to tell you I'm going to speak." Mm. Yeah, so, yeah.
You know, I want to see if we can get through this all without mentioning the man in Washington, but
yeah, because that'll put us in a bad mood.
Yeah, it would. the question that Thoreau and all of them and your man March were dealing with, sort of demonize or normalize, is a living question. Mm-hmm. When faced with something that is in so many ways outrageous, is there any connection to be drawn?
I would not mention he will not be named in the same breath as John Brown. This man has not one moral principle.
No, it's us. We're John Brown.
We're John Brown.
If anything, okay. the man who won't be named is sort of the reality of bondage.
Yeah. No, I'm not going to go there.
Okay. But no, I
resist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I'd love you to speak about David, but then also about your method of sort of, and with reference also to your foreign correspondence, your work with the Wall Street Journal, and your learning, but your method of plunging into faraway spots, far from Australia, far from Martha's Vineyard, far from Boston, and just letting the imagination work. I'd love to know how you do it. Literally, you know, how long it takes when the ideas come, slowly, gradually, in a flash.
The David book was very different because usually there are a wealth of written sources to draw on to get a sense of a voice. You know, you can find diaries and journals and letters, or in the case of people who were not literate, you can hear their voices in court in verbatim testimony going all the way back to the Spanish Inquisition. You can find women's voices. You can find the voices of enslaved people in court records.
But Spanish Inquisition turns out to be an incredible goldmine of hard data.
You know, just like, you know, when I heard that the CIA were taping the waterboarding, I thought, yep, and the Spanish Inquisitors took down such detailed notes of every interrogation. They would say, he screamed for 5 minutes. No, it's awful. And, you know, so I wrote about that in People of the Book, and I'm writing about essentially waterboarding. Mm. And then I pick up the newspaper and find out it's back, or maybe it was never gone, but exactly the same brutality and being carried out by people who thought that they were acting in a moral cause. Mm. Yeah.
Back to David and what you... how you.
So he, that was tough because there are no written... I mean, there's the Bible, yes. But outside the pages of the Bible, we've got nothing, nothing. And that really surprised me. Not that there weren't, you know, I wasn't surprised that the Hebrew tribes, very scattered, very disorganized at that, you know, period, didn't have records, but that the surrounding societies, Mesopotamia and Egypt, which did have chronicles that he's not even mentioned anywhere. Mm. And all we've got in a material sense is a one stone inscription that references the house of David. Mm-hmm. And then everything else is conjectural. So there are some ruins of palaces that could have been associated with a leader of his stature at that time. But it is so far back in the past. So at that point, you have to take this leap and make the decision. What do you believe? Do you believe that people were of a different kind and degree, you know, 2000 BC, or do you 1000 BC? Or do you think the human heart was the human heart, and that jealousy and hatred and love and tenderness were the same as we experience them? Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of in the latter camp. And so, if you accept that, then you have a way into a life that's so impossibly distant.
Mm. And, well, you know, David is such a, sort of a template for everything that comes afterward, including Michelangelo, including the Psalms that will be reading and quoting tomorrow, and it, every day.
No, I mean, when a friend of mine had a horrible tragedy a year or two ago when her son committed suicide, and she said for 6 months all she could read, all she could bear to read were the Psalms.
Praise God.
And I thought, how amazing that somebody can still minister to you in your grief at that incredible remote distance. But that is, you know, I think speaking to the fact that we experience emotions exactly the same way through time. You know, the furniture changes, but the human heart stays the same.
It's to me almost incredible that you spin these things out of your own head and deep reading, of course, and research in Martha's Vineyard while we're all working away. You want to talk a little bit about your day, your process?
My process.
And your intention.
I love, you know, this idea that there's a process. the wonderful writer, Andrea, I'm having a senior moment. She, Barnett. Oh, God. Anyway, she Barrett, thank you. Thank you very much. She said she could no more explain her process than her dog can explain how the thing he scarfed up in the park ends up as the vomit on her carpet. But another artist, a friend of mine who's a sculptor named Sarah Z, I think puts it best. Oh. She said her process is mess, 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 art. And I love that because you can't make art every day, but you can make a mess every day. And if you make that mess every day following day, eventually you've got something to work with that you can start shaping out of the mess. And so I'm not really a big believer in writer's block because, you know, metal press operators don't get to have block and hairdressers don't get to have block. You know, you get up and you go to work. And so I get up and I sit at my desk and I try and stay there and not be distracted by wonderful NPR radio programs. But we always have it on, so you go down to I'm just going down to get a quick cup of coffee and then you're doing something sensational and I have to listen to it and there goes an hour.
And then, but do you want to, do we believe the madness of the process? That's sort of what Henry James said, you know, we do what we can, et cetera. But I'd love to know more about it. What was I going to say? Oh, how about scanning this world? You found, you know, ancient Hebrew documents. You find
very few.
Mr. March, I know. Where do you see a novel happening?
The ideas are the easy part. The ideas just fly in through the window, sometimes like gift wrap packages, and it's more like there's too many of them, I'll never get to them all. And it's like planes circling at Newark. Which one are you going to wave in? The idea is not the problem. I mean, the past is full of these fantastic improbabilities, things that if you made them up wouldn't be. I mean, if I had made up a story that a Native American raised in his own language and culture learned Latin and Greek and sat down and graduated from Harvard in 1665 with the sons of the Puritan colonial elite, nobody would have been interested in that because it would be implausible. You know, Mark Twain said, fiction must be plausible, truth needn't be. So I like to find these implausible truths in history that a village opted to quarantine itself voluntarily during bubonic plague. Now it happened. So so I like to find those kind of places to work, but if you know too much, then it's not for me. It would be for a narrative historian. But it's the stories that have a big void. So we don't know what Caleb Cheshire Tiahmuk's life was like. We know the bare fact that he went to Harvard and that he graduated, but we don't know what it was like to be him because we don't have a journal. I love to think that moldering away in some attic in Cambridge, there is a journal. But we didn't have it. So you have to then find out everything you can about the material culture of the time, about the way people thought and spoke and believed, and then you can say, well, maybe, just maybe, it might have been something like this.
Back to the broadest question, where we find ourselves, with those two questions implied. My sister, who's lived in Portugal for the last 40 years, wrote me and my other brothers this week and saying, what in the world? She was reading the Jane Mayer piece in the New Yorker on Vice President Pence, and she said, how in the world did it come to this, and the whole picture? And I was in a hurry, but I said, read Moby Dick. I do believe that we find the truth, even of the present situation, in fiction. God knows, in Melville, among many others. But do you want to either, you can shoot me down or just explain how it is, why it is. I keep wanting to know what Updike would be saying about the world, or Philip Roth for that matter, all sorts of people. What can the novelist tell us? There is a school out there that only the novelists know. What do you think?
I don't know. I'm not really in the business of telling readers what to think.
Draw the picture that kind of encompasses.
I lose myself in a story. And I think that, you know, I know from the way I read that every time you read a book, it's a different book because you're different. So you find in fiction what you need to find at that moment when you have that encounter with it. So, you know, just a very banal example was, you know, I read Lord of the Rings when I was 13, and at that point I was feeling very powerless the way 13-year-olds do, and the story that I got out of it was that even seemingly insignificant people can have a profound effect. And then when I read it to my son many, many years later, at the time of the Iraq War, what really struck me about that book is that to confront evil, you have to sacrifice a lot that's beautiful and good. And I wouldn't have, that wouldn't have been the book a 13-year-old read. So I think there's this wonderful, mysterious alchemy that happens between the writer and the reader. And it's kind of a sacred encounter.
Yeah. We'd love to hear questions from the audience. And while you're thinking about rushing to the mic, let me ask one more, a Moby Dick question. I mean, that's the beauty of Moby Dick. I'm reading it, I think, the fifth or sixth time, seventh time now. And, you know, I first read it was a whale adventure, but it had a Cold War reading. It has a post-Cold War reading. It has an environmental reading. What in the world are we doing destroying these beasts, et cetera? And it has a kind of endlessly unfolding message about who we are, and he somehow caught it in 1851. I think he went to his grave saying, "I've written, in effect, the fifth gospel, and nobody's going to read it." And too bad. But can any writer anticipate the multiple meanings? Or can you attack a subject with an openness to multiple meanings that will keep revealing themselves?
I'm no Melville.
Well, no. Nobody's Dr.
Call me Schlemiel. Yes, ideally that's what we are all hoping for, but I don't think of it like that when I'm lumbering along trying to get up off the runway, you know. Just trying to get that crate into the air one more time.
Is there a question, a thought, a very brief comment from the audience? Please. You've been terrific, and you encourage us.
Very shy. Yes.
How did you make that first step from nonfiction journalism to fiction? It seems like a big step.
Yeah, it did seem like it. More like a blind leap, really. But I have the Nigerian secret police to thank for my fiction career, and also my oldest son, because I was working, I loved every step I took as a journalist, and I would have probably done it forever, except I went to Nigeria to report on Shell Oil being in cahoots with the brutal military dictatorship of Sani Abacha. And I was reporting on a massacre of unarmed farmers who'd protested the despoliation of their land. And then, as you do as a journalist, I went to the military to get their side of the story. Big mistake. They threw me in the slammer. I didn't know how long they were going to keep me. And I'm lying on this concrete floor in this awful lockup with malarial mosquitoes zooming around. And I thought, I thought of all the journalists who'd been detained. And I thought of Terry Anderson, who at that point was, 8 years in a Beirut dungeon. And I thought, if they keep me for 8 years, I forgot to get pregnant. So lucky for me, they deported me after only 3 days. And I came home and greeted my husband with great enthusiasm. And our son was born the following year. And at that point, I needed a new gig because I didn't want to go off on long open-ended assignments to places where you might get thrown in the slammer. So I'd had this, we'd been hiking 10 years earlier in the Peak District in England. And we stumbled upon this finger post sign that said Eam, and underneath it said Plague Village. Not many places try to attract tourists by putting up signs that say Plague Village, but it worked for me. Mm-hmm. And we went there, and in the church, they had a wonderful display telling what had happened when plague came from London, probably in a bolt of contaminated cloth that an itinerant tailor had ordered, and how the villagers took this unique decision to quarantine themselves. And that the facts of that and speculating about what it was like to be in that village when it was locked off from the world for a year had sort of taken hold of my imagination. I'd spent 10 years thinking about it before it occurred to me that I could sit down and actually write a novel. And so I sat down and I wrote 3 chapters and the ending, and I had a nonfiction agent already at this point, and I sent it to her, and I said, tell me if it's crap, because I guess I can figure out how to get somebody to hire me to do some kind of journalism that doesn't require hiking over the Hindu Kush. and I didn't hear from her, and I thought, oh, well, she hated it, so, plan B. And then she called me up, and she'd sold it. So then I had to write it. So that was the transition. Yeah.
Wonderful question. Superlative answer. Thank you. Thank you.
Can you comment on the structure of the book? I love that from end to beginning. Ah. At the end of each chapter, I would, in my mind, make it go to the beginning. So at the very end, it took me quite a while to think of the whole book.
Oh. Thank you. This is a question about the structure of people of the book. And for those who haven't read it, it's about an actually existing Hebrew manuscript that's been saved on multiple occasions by some very unlikely rescuers, including a Catholic priest in 1609, and twice by Muslim librarians, once from the Nazis and once during the Bosnian War.
That part is true.
That's true. Mm. We don't know how it was created and who the artist was, because at that point there was a belief among art historians that there was no medieval Jewish figurative art because of the commandment, thou shalt not make any graven image or likeness of anything. And yet here's this book full of these fantastic illustrations that are about the story of the Exodus, but there are also little glimpses of medieval Spanish Jewish life. And so the deepest mysteries of the book are why was it illustrated and who illustrated it? So I wanted the structure of the novel to work towards the answer to that question. And when I gave it to Tony, my husband, to read in manuscript, he's like, why don't you just start at the beginning and tell the story? He didn't like the structure at all. So thank you for being a discerning reader.
Please.
I was interested in Caleb's crossing. Obviously, there
Well,
what did he think of Harvard Square, you know?
The Wampanoag, Native Americans in general are early adopters. Whenever something came in their path that was useful, they made it their own. Like our image of Plains Indians on horseback, right? But there were no horses here until the Spanish brought them. And yet it's such an entrenched early adopter every time. The thing that they saw on Martha's Vineyard that they wanted to adopt was written language. So we have very, very early writings from Wampanoag point of view. And then we have... and then we have fantastic...
say it again.
Speak into the mic. Yes. Yeah, okay. So these wonderful journals that were kept by the misguided ministers who came to try and convert the Wampanoag, and one of them was young Minister Cotton, who had been caught en flagrante stooping a parishioner for his penance. He had to go for a year to Martha's Vineyard and try and convert, and he kept great notes on what people said to him. Mm. And these are the kind of gifts as a historical novelist. You just pillage it, you know. So there's this wonderful, description of him trying to explain sin to the Wampanoag, and he said they had no ready conception of this, and they refused to believe that they were sinners, even though I tried to convince them of it and assured them of it. And then he said original sin was particularly difficult because, he tells them the Genesis story, and he's confronted by a tribal elder who says, it's a ridiculous story. Why would God make a garden and then forbid his children its fruit? And even if this ridiculous story was true, why would he be angry with me about it, who only learned of it today?
wonderful answer, wonderful question. Thank you. A question into the mic, please. Or we can repeat it. I wonder, does the famous husband want to get a word in?
I see a hand over there. We can repeat the question, yeah.
I was wondering what you were like as a child.
Well, I can help you out there. What was I like as a child? I actually wrote a little book about that, and it's called Foreign Correspondence. I was nerdy. I was pretty unhealthy. I spent a lot of time not at school, but that was okay because my mother was the best teacher you could imagine, full of imagination and passion for words. Not so great at math, so my math has always been weak. But I was such a nerdy kid. My favorite thing to do was collect pen pals from all around the world, and I would wait for these letters to come. I thought, at that point, Sydney was, we lived in a very small world. We didn't have a car. We never went anywhere. So it was all about books, trips to the library, and an imagined life that I lived through these kids in France and in Israel and the United States. And so, nerdy little girl.
Please. No need to no need to answer if you don't want to, but dare I ask what you're working on?
Oh, I'm in agony. It's so hard. It's a book. I really need to get my elevator pitch for this book down because it's very hard.
Try it on the Boston Book Festival.
So I got invited to Plymouth Plantation right after Caleb's Crossing came out, and I thought I was invited there to be chum in the water for a donor's lunch. But it turned out that no, they had brought me there to lunch to pitch me an idea for a book about a young woman from the Plymouth colony, and they had a lot of information about her, and they had reconstructed the house she lived in, and they knew what she wore, and they said, you could live in that house and wear her clothes. And I was like, whoa, that's catnip. But there was only one small problem, which was that I'd just written that book. Bethia Mayfield was that character, and I was out of stuff, and also I didn't want to live in a Calvinist mindset for another 3 years. Boy, can you imagine not knowing if you're saved or damned? Like, what a problem. You know, there's this terrible digression, but there's this amazing, heartbreaking court testimony by this young woman who's thrown her baby down the well, and she said, the one good thing that's come out of my terrible sin is that I can now be sure that I'm damned and I don't have to think about it anymore. Mm. Yeah. Anyway, so I'm nodding and smiling and eating my salad and thinking this is never going to happen. Meanwhile, across the table, there's a guy from the Smithsonian, and he's the guy who deals with all the Smithsonian Associate Museums, and Plymouth is one. And he'd just come from the Museum of the Horse in Lexington, Kentucky. And he's talking about delivering the skeleton of this horse that had been sitting in an attic in the Smithsonian, and people had forgotten the story of this horse and how famous it was and what a brilliant racehorse it was and how fast it was. They invented the stopwatch to clock it, and how, you know, the horse had... in the Civil War, remarkable things happened to this horse, and I'm like, can you pipe down about that Puritan? I really need to hear about this horse. So that's the book I'm writing now, and it's called Horse.
Please.
I spoke to you before the session about the other panel you are on today and the work you've done with a group of artists working in Israel. And I'm wondering if you can just talk to what's the role, or what it's been like as fiction writers, you know, being involved in a very volatile and difficult situation, and is there an obligation for people like you to speak about contemporary world events, other than the guy that cannot be named?
Yeah, no, for me, so this is a project of Michael Chabon and Isla Waldman, and for the 50th anniversary of the occupation, they ask writers to go as guests of an Israeli group called Breaking the Silence, which are veterans of the Israeli Defense Force who have served in the occupied territories and who have spoken out against occupation. And so for me, it was a chance to go back and revisit after, 30 years, this place that had consumed my working life when I was a foreign correspondent there. We arrived in 1987, just in time for the first intifada. And I was telling...
You arrived in Jerusalem?
Well, we were living in Cairo, but I told everybody this morning, so anyone who was at that session, forgive the repetition, but before I took up the assignment, they sent me to Washington for a round of briefings on the region, and I went to a briefing by Reagan's national security advisor, and he walked me around the countries of the region telling me what the key issues were and what to expect, and he gets to Israel-Palestine, and he said, you won't spend much time there. There's really nothing going on. The young Palestinians just want to make money and be entrepreneurial, and they're not interested in politics. Which explains a lot about our predicament as a country, right? Because 5 minutes after I got there, I was heading to Israel. The Intifada had erupted in Gaza. And it was the Intifada of the Stones, these young boys confronting this great army in a very David and Goliath-like way. And so I spent a tremendous amount of time reporting in the occupied territories. And when Ayelet asked me to go back, at first I really didn't want to do it. I thought, it's like the prophet Jonah. Every time he's asked to prophesy, he doesn't want to do it, and he goes and takes a nap. And my first instinct was to go and take a really long nap and let Ayelet go to the occupied territories. But I went, and I'm glad I did go back and reconnect with that story. And yeah, I do think. I stopped being a journalist just because I wanted to be home for my kids. And now my kids, one's a senior in college and the other one's a freshman, and he's gone off to boarding school, much to my astonishment. And so why couldn't I go back to doing some journalism? I probably will.
Fascinating. Another question or two, if there's time. I want to ask another sort of working. What are you reading with pleasure today? Fiction and nonfiction.
Well, I'm reading a tremendous amount about 19th century racing. And also because this is why this book's hard to explain. It does come into, it comes forward into the 1950s and the birth of the abstract expressionist movement in New York. So I'm reading a lot about de Kooning and Pollock and so fabulous biographies. What am I reading for fun? Just read a book by a wonderful Australian author, Tim Winton. He has a new book coming out, and that is just, it blows your hair back. It's brilliant. It's called The Shepherd's Hut, so watch out for that one. What else? A book by a New Zealand author. It's called The Chimes, and it's a dystopian novel about, it's set in the aftermath of something that's referred to as the All Breaking, and it turns out that an acoustical weapon has been used. Anyway, it's very poetic and beautiful book. She's a violinist, and there's a tremendous amount about music in this novel, so I loved that one.
What are we missing, those of us who've never been to Australia?
Oh, it's fabulous. You
the dystopia,
go.
The utopia, the whole thing.
Yeah, you have to go to Australia, and you can, so.
I just remember that, I think a letter to the Times or something the Clinton impeachment time. Somebody wrote from Australia saying, thank God we got the convicts, you got the Puritans.
It's interesting because superficially the societies are very similar and there's so many commonalities and it's very easy to feel at home. And yet we are so different in our foundational narrative. You know, you guys are propelled across the sea on this tide of high idealism, and where the despised, poor, dragged, kicking and screaming.
You're Mr. Micawber, right?
I mean. Yeah, yeah. What was
the debtors.
Jack Maggs. Jack Maggs.
Magwitch.
Yes, yeah. So, yeah, no, I mean, it's, and so what happens, you're very suspicious of authority. You don't rise by putting your foot in somebody else's face. You don't think you can do it on your own, because nobody could do it on their own in Australia. The land wasn't like 3 meters down of topsoil the way, you know, people found when they went west here. It was this like thin layer of almost nothing and a very harsh environment. So it's a much more communitarian ethos.
That leaves out Rupert Murdoch and what he's doing to our world.
One bullet, if I could go back.
Careful. Careful. Is there a last question from the floor, please?
I'm interested in
Yeah, well, it's fantastic.
The creative partnership being married to another writer.
Yes, well, it's been a while. It's coming on for 33 years, and I can't imagine life any other way because we're each other's first readers and sounding board, and nothing leaves the premises without it getting a heavy edit, which can lead to some frosty dinner tables. But no, it's really good, and it's even better now. We used to have, when we were young and poor, we used to have to work in the same room, and we now can afford. I can afford to stick him out in the barn.
Hawthorne got through it with Sophia.
Yes, not so happily for Sophia, I think.
Sorry?
Not so happily for Sophia, if I remember correctly.
Well, she had her moments, but she certainly participated in a big way. Elizabeth Barrett Browning is the world title holder, right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. I think you're bearing down on the record. You know? last word, Tony? Last chance.
And
Thank you. You're a wonderful audience. Thank God for the Boston Book Festival.
Yeah.